And we are here in Old Louisville, Kentucky. And I am in front of the Conrad Caldwell House. Wow. This is really beautiful. And basically what it says is the house was purchased by the St. James Court Association in 1987 and turned into a museum. Built of Bedford limestone with elaborate archways and stone designs, it was known for its woodwork and parquet floors. The house also featured many innovations of its day, including interior plumbing and electric lighting. Wow, this is beautiful. Let's see. Wow, look at this, Henry. This is beautiful. Yep. This is the Conrad Caldwell House Museum. This is beautiful. It looks like such a Gothic type of home. And yeah, I can imagine this would be lovely. Let me see if I could take a look up there. For an event, this would be beautiful. Yeah, let's see. Oh, they have twilight tours, which we missed because they stopped in September, 5 and 7 p.m. Wow. This is beautiful.
Hi everybody. So there you see me on a recent trip that I made to Louisville, Kentucky. And when I was there, unfortunately, as you can see, I arrived too late for the tour. And I was in an area of Louisville called Millionaire's Row. Now, this was an area that towards the end of the 19th century was where the movers and shakers, new and old money, built their houses on the outskirts of what was then the outskirts of Louisville. And one of the houses or mansions built was the one you saw me at, which is called the Conrad Caldwell House or the Castle. And of course, not surprisingly, it has a reputation for being haunted. Now, the original gentleman who built it was a name by the name of Theophilus Conrad. He was born in Strasbourg, France in 1832, and he was born into a wealthy family there who were glue manufacturers. Now, before he came to the United States, he traveled throughout Europe and America, and then one of the most important things that he did was he apprenticed with an uncle, and he learned the business of tanning, and that's where he made his money when he eventually came to Louisville with his family. He was a tanner, and he moved here with his wife, who they had married in 1857. Her name was Mariana, and they had seven children, four of whom lived into adulthood. There were four daughters, Amina, Lucille, Carrie, and Emma. Now, the family finally moved into this home in 1895, and while he was there, he was already, by this time, into his 60s, and he even conducted business from the house. And she played hostess to many guests, where they had a lot of parties. Eventually, their daughters married, moved away. And in February of 1905, Mr. Conrad suffers a heart attack and drops dead on the basement stairs in the house. And he was 73 at that time. Now, his widow, Marie, she holds on to the house for like only three more years. In 1908, turns around and sells it to a couple by the last name of Caldwell, who were good friends of theirs. And this was a gentleman, his name was William Caldwell. And again, he was from New York. He had married a lady by the name of Elaine, and they had moved to Louisville in 1887 because, again, people were coming here back in those days after the Civil War to make their fortunes. This was like the western edge of the United States, and people, new and old money, would come out here to make more money, and he was not originally from Kentucky. So anyway, the Caldwell buy the house from the Conrad's widow. They move in there. They have two children, Walter and Grace. Grace had a little bit of a sad history. When she's 8 years old, she contracts scarlet fever. And by the time she's 21, she's completely deaf. She does go on to marry. But now in 1925, William's wife, Elaine, she dies. And he turns around and remarries in 1930. And he continues to live in this house until he dies in 1938. And at that time, their children, Walter and Grace, within a few years, maybe 6 years, in 1944, as a matter of fact, they turn around and they sell the house to Vesta Lasley. And she operates it as a boarding house, mostly for the female students and faculty over at the University of Louisville. Now, I do want to mention that by this time in the 1940s, a lot of these beautiful mansions that are on what is this street called St. James Court, many of them had become boarding houses, flop houses, and in some cases even bordellos. In other words, this area deteriorated from the time when it was originally built and it used to house the important families of Louisville. And I guess at that time it really wasn't that much of a millionaire's row, in other words. So anyway, in 1948, within 4 years, the Presbyterian Church, they purchase it. And they establish it as the Rose Anna Hughes Home for Widows. And it functioned as what we call either a rest home or a nursing home all the way into the mid-1980s. And then it was purchased by the St. James Court Historic Foundation and turned into a museum, which is what you saw when I visited. The Home for Widows was for Presbyterian ladies over the age of 65, I guess, that needed a place to live. Maybe, you know, through infirmity, etc. Now, of course, the people that have experienced most of the hauntings are the tour guides that work there. Because, of course, they're in and out. Now, whether the people that lived there all those years have experienced anything, I have a feeling they did. It's just that back in those years, people didn't talk about those things. So the tour guides there that have worked there since the mid-1980s, they're the ones that have reported ghostly manifestations. One of them is reported to be Mr. Caldwell, who has appeared to different people that are in the tour groups, especially when they kind of like go off by themselves and start exploring. There was one lady, this is in the 1990s, she supposedly had gone up to a third floor room that was closed for renovations. Within a few minutes, she comes down the stairs screaming. And when they asked her, of course, what happened, she's saying that a mean little man was shaking a finger at her. But what really caused her to go screaming down the stairs was that she knew he had to be a ghost, for she saw right through him to the wood paneling on the other side of the room. Yeah, that's usually a good sign. Now, when the Caldwells moved into this mansion, Mrs. Caldwell had designed a billiard room for her husband. And you have to understand, this was, remember back then, this was also the time around where gentlemen went off and smoked a cigar and played billiards away from the ladies. And usually they had a room onto themselves. And there was a lot of, this was, remember, bourbon, a lot of fortunes were made with the bourbon industry here in Louisville. So this was apparently one of his favorite rooms that Mrs. Caldwell had made for him. And again, same thing. A lot of people that visit the museum and have gone off by themselves, they have a sighting of a short man in the billiard room. And one of the tourists, as a matter of fact, again in the 90s, saw a portrait of Mr. Caldwell and said, "That's the guy I saw that startled me when I walked into the room." Apparently, maybe he didn't look that ghostly. He looked more solid. Another thing is, this location is used as a venue for newlyweds holding the receptions. And there, they're either newlyweds or people in the party also have witnessed ghostly manifestations. One time there was a newlywed had a reception and they saw Mr. Caldwell's ghost. And they said that as they walked through the front walkway, they turn around and they see an old man wearing like an old-fashioned suit standing on the third floor balcony and he's smoking a cigar. At this point, they're thinking this is a real man. So they turn around and they ask their relatives, who is this guy on the third floor? When they look again, he's disappeared. They go into the house, search it. They can't find anybody. They go into the billiards room, which happens to be the room that is attached to the balcony where they saw this man, and they still smell a little bit of cigar smoke. Now, people who know the history of the house say that this makes sense because this was the balcony that was used for smoking during the time that the Caldwells owned the house, and that the billiards room was Mr. Caldwell's favorite room, and where he almost like for all intents and purposes lived there. And they're saying that they think that he's the one that haunts the house because apparently he also died in the home. All right. Now, his wife, who died about, 8 years before, she also died in the house. She was ill for, like, the last 2 years of her life, and she was confined to her bedroom up on the second story of the house. Now, there have been other incidents that point to her as being one of the ghosts or the one that causes unexplained things to happen. There was a lady that worked there. She says that she was coming down the stairs. She was locking up the museum to leave. And she sees a mist-like form on the stairs. Now, she realizes that she's got to go by this mist in order to get to the front door. And she says it was right by the grandfather clock and it's just hanging there in the air. Eventually, she just decides to go down. And when she turns around, the mist is gone. So she goes right back up and to where it was at. And she feels it has a very cold spot. Now, why she thinks it was Mrs. Caldwell, maybe she saw something in the outline. There was another housekeeper that also had an encounter with what she called Mrs. Caldwell's ghost. She's cleaning the stairs at the front of the house. All of a sudden, storm's approaching. She's not realizing that it's raining until she hears the rain coming down, and then it turns into a very hard rain. According to her, she all of a sudden she hears a frantic female voice from the third floor calling, "The windows are open." She goes upstairs and finds that several of the windows are open. This is around the time that she realizes that she is the only one in the house. And she's thinking, she assumed, who knows, maybe what other experiences she might have had prior to this, that it was Mrs. Caldwell who was warning her, you need to go upstairs and close the windows, because apparently Mrs. Caldwell was very protective of her belongings and the house. There was another time, there's a wedding party there. They're holding the reception. And they also think that they ran into what was Mrs. Caldwell. The groom's aunt, she's there helping decorate the stairs along with other family members. And she says she sees an old-fashioned silver spoon floating in the air in front of her. And she's watching it as it floats over to the butler's pantry, falls on the floor. She goes over, picks it up, probably inspecting it very closely, at least I would. And then she notices that there's a safe there and the door of the safe is open. And apparently this is the safe where Mrs. Caldwell would keep her best silver. So she goes over, she looks in, and she sees other similar spoons inside. So she puts this spoon in there and closes it. Later on, she's telling her relatives what happened to her. None of them believe her. But the people that worked there did believe her, apparently because this was not the first time that something similar had happened to them. Now, there was another director who said that they believe that there's three women from when it was a Presbyterian home that still inhabit the house. And they attribute that if they move things around, that they get upset. And that they open the doors and they move them things around. And that the way they accommodate these ghostly ladies supposedly is they say hello to them every morning. Now, as romantic as it may seem to think that the ones that haunt this place are the two original owners, the Conrads and the Caldwells, who from what I see all died in this house, you have to think also for 4 years it was a boarding house. For over 40 years it was what we call a rest home or nursing home. And I've included there some of the newspaper clips of the obituaries, just only a small fraction of the ones that I found where these ladies died in that house, which by the way was not uncommon. People would die, not like now where most people sometimes die in a hospital. They died there. And I was also surprised to find that a really large amount of the obituaries, I would say about 80% of these ladies, never married, because it very clearly stated on the obituaries, Miss So-and-so. And it was surprising how many of these Presbyterian ladies never married. Some of them were quite elderly. Some of them lived there for a few years. Point being that I would say that probably a good portion of the hauntings or disturbances, things being moved, cold spots, are attributed to the 40-something years that it was a resting home, a nursing home. And remember, we really don't have a backstory to any of these ladies that lived there. By the time they got there, they were just elderly. Who knows what tragedy and drama followed them around, what kind of people they were. So again, I know it's not as romantic as thinking that the original owner or the ex-lady of the house are the ones that are haunting and being protective. They need to look closer at all those 40-something years that so many people lived and died there. Now, you're going to see me take a moonlight drive through the streets of Old Louisville. And on the way, I am going to tell you some of the best, most classic ghost stories attached to Millionaire's Row, all about the ghosts of the Gilded Age. Hi, everybody. So here I am driving after hours through the streets of Old Louisville, especially in this area called Millionaire's Row. As I mentioned before, there was a time where this neighborhood had fallen into disrepair and just became, for lack of a better word, very seedy. But in recent years, a lot of people have come in, they've bought these historic homes, at least the ones that were not hit by the wrecking ball. And that's one of the things that's unusual about this area of Old Louisville, is that there's a large area that was spared from demolition, which has happened in a lot of other cities across the United States. And if you look at one of my prior shows where I interviewed David Domine, the title of the video is Ghosts of the Gilded Age. And he talks about his own experience where he bought and lived in one of the houses here in Millionaire's Row. And he's, as a matter of fact, he's written several books all about this neighborhood. So if you have a chance, go and take a look at that past video with David and check into his interesting books. Several of them, but he has some that are specifically about this area. So let's get to the first story. And the first story is the Ice Boy Ghost. Now, incredibly, the story about this child ghost is tied into the original owner of the Conrad Caldwell Castle. And this is how it ties in. Now, this haunting is connected to a building that was there on that same street, which is St. James Court. And the name of the building was St. James Court Flats. And this is one of the first apartments buildings that were built there in this area in 1897. And it was built by Mr. Theophilus Conrad. He was the one that proposed it. However, he got a lot of opposition from all the other millionaires who lived at St. James Court because they were thinking, you are going to bring down our property values because here we've built all these beautiful mansions. And he wanted to build a six-story apartment building. They even took him to court, but he won the day and they built it. Now, the way this story comes about is that originally this building was built with six stories. However, on a very cold, cold February evening in 1912, February of 1912, a fire, mysterious fire, starts to burn this entire structure. Now, rumor had it that a disgruntled neighbor had basically committed arson almost as an act of revenge. In other words, you know, we couldn't get this building out of here legally. Well, we're going to get rid of it one way or the other. Again, this was only rumor. At the end, it was a terrible blaze, and there were several people that were trapped in the upper floors. Fortunately, everyone was able to get out, and when they came back the next morning, they found that it had been that cold that the water that was used by the firemen or the fire brigades had basically frozen in place, and what they had was a burnt out shell layered by thick ice. Now, within a short amount of time, as a matter of fact, within the first snowfall, considering this was February, it was probably within that month, people in the area start reporting, especially late at night, that they see a little boy in tattered clothing running around the fountain that was situated in front of where this apartment building used to be. And if you look at my movie, you're going to see that there's a part where coming around this fountain, that's the fountain that we're talking about. Sometimes he was even seen inside the building itself. And this is like what they call street urchin. He was in tattered clothing. Obviously, he wasn't dressed appropriately for the weather, for the cold weather. And that the people that saw him said his face was streaked with dirt and he's very grungy looking, and nobody could account for where or who this boy was. Now, that whole building was rebuilt. However, the uppermost floors, which were the ones that had been the most damaged due to the fire, they didn't repair that. They only repaired the bottom portion. So, whether it was arson or unintentionally, the unmillionaires got what they wanted, because instead of six stories, it ended up just being a three-story building. And as you could tell, most of these buildings or these houses that were already in place, that's exactly what they were. They were three stories. As you can tell, most usually that third story was where the servants and sometimes the children's nursery were located. Now, it's around this time that there's another rumor that starts to circulate saying that someone had indeed died in the fire. However, nobody was talking about it. And the belief is that little boy that was seen running around only on really cold nights, just like the one that occurred when the fire took place, was a young boy from a poor neighborhood close by called the Cabbage Patch. And he was out making deliveries, grocery deliveries, trying to make money for his family. Remember, these are the times that even young children would be out working. There's no child labor laws in 1912, especially if your family was very poor. And he had dropped, the story goes that he had dropped off this box of groceries to one of the apartments on the top floor. And because it was so cold, he might have still been upstairs before going out. Maybe he had just made the delivery. In the end, the rumor goes that he was up there when the fire broke out and they just weren't able to get him out. Even if they maybe were even aware that he was there, because remember, he didn't live there. So maybe they were only looking for the people that lived in those apartments that they knew were there. And supposedly the story is that the next day, his body full of soot was found huddled in a corner. But because he was from the Cabbage Patch, one of the poor neighborhoods, the newspapers never reported his death. The truth is, we don't know really the story, but that sounds very plausible. Where, you know, this one building, even if it wasn't welcomed by the neighbors, was on a very wealthy street where the last thing that these owners wanted was to have a scandal where a child was killed, even if it was accidentally, by a fire that broke out. So, who is the ghostly boy? Nobody really truly knows, but that sounds like a very plausible origin for the story. And again, he's only seen on the coldest nights, just like the night that he might have died. Now, the next story is about a ghost called Annie Whipple. Okay, now, the house where she's said to haunt is situated on the northwest corner of Park Avenue and 4th Street. And like a lot of these beautiful mansions, it has this beautiful staircase that curves around, goes to the second floor. And it's reported that it's been renovated and used as a bed and breakfast. And the overnight guests are the ones that report about a lot of the hauntings. They claim that late in the evenings, they see what looks like the shadow of a woman. And she appears to be like that old school teacher spinster type. And she's seen rushing up and down the stairs. And somewhere along the line, it was identified that this is the ghost of a lady by the name of Annie Whipple. Now, Annie's history is that she was a widow who arrived in Louisville from New England in the late 1800s. Her husband had been a whaling captain who was lost at sea. And she became a living, what they call either a nanny or a governess, to a family by the last name of Houston who lived in this home. And she was very well liked and respected by this family. Now, she had been with the family for maybe 2 or 3 years when there was a yellow fever epidemic that struck the city, including the household. Now, she stepped in and she's helped nurse back the family, but one of the children, a little girl that she had become very attached to, wasn't getting any better. And the doctor was telling the family that there was really nothing more that he could do. In other words, he was preparing them that this child was going to die. Now, the story goes that Annie refuses to give up on this little girl and is at her bedside day in, day out. And she was doing everything that she could think of to stop the fever. At this point, this child's in delirium. So she's kind of getting desperate because at this point, remember, the parents have been told this child's going to die. The doctor that usually attends to the family saying, look, I cannot do any more. So Annie is said to have gone through the local newspaper. And when she's reading it, she sees a story about a local medium. And remember, this is also the time that the spiritualism is very popular throughout the United States. But she wasn't really a spiritualist, but she sees a story that catches her attention. And what she reads is that there's a local doctor who supposedly cures people that are suffering from all different types of ailments. In some cases, what he calls, in other words, things where people don't get better or that they might be bewitched. And she is thinking, I really want to try everything. So she's thinking, I'm going to get a hold of this man, even though she doesn't subscribe to the belief system. So she goes to see this Dr. Anderson. Now, when she gets to where he lives at, She finds that the front doors of the doctor's house and the office where he was practicing, from which, by the way, that was very common, where doctors would live and practice basically out of the same building, they're all decked out in black bunting. And she finds out that Dr. Anderson just died the day before from the yellow fever. So she's very upset because she's thinking, this is my last chance to save this child. So she goes back to the little girl's bedside. And again, the story goes that she would just sit herself next to this child and just read the newspaper, just to occupy herself. The next day, she's reading this portion about the spiritualist news. And she reads a story about how there's certain individuals that believe that they can communicate with the dead. And even supposedly respected scientists are saying that they're successful doing this. So she thinks of this idea where she wants to contact the spirit of Dr. Anderson, who just passed away, hoping that somehow or other she can extract from him the information from the great beyond as to what she should do or what he would have done in order to save this little girl. Okay, now somewhere in this, she gets in contact with an old African woman who knows about these things, and kind of like encourages her that she should go and get a hold of the ghost or the shade of Dr. Anderson and try to get this information from him from the other side. Supposedly, this woman, this old African woman, she was a former slave named Josephine. Some people say that she was Kentucky, others say that she was from Louisiana, which might also explain why she knew some voodoo. So she apparently she starts to work with this with Josephine in order to get a hold of the ghost of Dr. Anderson. And she explains why she wants to do it. She gives Josephine some money and listens to what Josephine tells her to do. Okay, and the story then goes that she starts to do what's called automatic writing. And it's known also as psychography. And this is, of course, when you have psychic ability and you're allowing a spirit to basically possess you up to a certain point, and your own hand, you write out the message that they want to deliver. So this was how Annie thought she was going to be able to communicate and get instructions from Dr. Anderson. So she sits at a table and she gets a writing utensil of paper. Now she uses, Josephine had given her this powder, okay, and it tells her this is what you need to pray to summon, to conjure up the spirit of Dr. Anderson. So Annie does all of this, but then she starts to feel a presence close by her. And then she falls into what is like a deep trance, where she's asking Dr. Anderson on advice on how to cure the little girl. And she goes ahead and she starts writing something across the paper. And when she looks at the message, it looks like it's some type of medical prescription that she's written out. So, of course, she is thinking most definitely she's in contact with Dr. Anderson, because she had no medical knowledge whatsoever. So the next morning, she goes to an apothecary that's close by, has a prescription filled, goes immediately up to where the sick girl is upstairs and gives her this potion, whatever that was put together. Now, she's looking at this little girl, and the minutes tick, become hours, and this child is not getting any better. As a matter of fact, she starts getting worse and even falls into a coma. And the doctor, the regular doctor, is brought back in, and he explains that definitely this child is going to die that very day. Now, Annie supposedly is shocked. All right, she has tried everything that she can think of to save this child, which sounds like she had probably gotten attached to as much as if it was her own daughter. All right, so Annie runs back to her room, does the same exercise, lights a candle, sprinkles this powder, gets another piece of writing paper, and again starts summoning the ghost, the spirit, for assistance. And even though she's entranced, she's still aware of her surrounding, and she feels again when her hand grabs the pen and she starts to scrawl out this message, writing something out. However, instead of her writing, okay, she starts to like slash across the wooden top of the desk. In other words, she's aware, which is the way this works, where only her arm and her hand are possessed, and she's gouging the table that the paper's on. Obviously, it's like a savage attack on the wood. So she's surprised that she's even doing this. And eventually, of course, the paper's torn to shreds. However, there's one large piece that remains. And she scribbles very quickly a message. And what she reads to her terror was the words, "You fool, I am not Dr. Anderson." So, of course, she falls to the floor and she's put to bed. And she herself, maybe through her own exhaustion, also starts running a fever. And she comes to and she confesses. She tells, I guess, the household members, "This is what I did. I was trying to make the girl better, and this is what I did." Okay, which turns out in a way to have been what they call a deathbed confession, because she dies. She dies by the following day. But she did have one comfort, that by the time she's dying, the child that she had been trying to save, her fever had broken, and she had come to her bedside. And who knows whether she had gotten cured because of what Annie had done for her, or whether she just was a child and she was able to resist the infection. She survived. Or, like what some people think, did she make an exchange for saving the child, for the young girl? You know, maybe it was obviously not Dr. Anderson's spirit, but another spirit who was very cruel and basically wanted to terrorize somebody that opened a portal. And the truth is, nobody can ever know. But the legend is that it's Annie Whipple's ghost whose fate it is to go up and down the curved stairway in this mansion where the family once lived and where she cared for their children. Whether she just thought of it as spiritualism or dabbling in the black arts, nobody knows. But apparently, she seems to be trapped in that never-ending effort to save the child. And her spirit has forgotten, ultimately, that she did achieve it, but in exchange for her own life. Now, the next story, it's called Little Girl Lost. And this revolves around a house where two sisters, Susan and Linda, bought it in order to restore it. And not surprisingly, this is the time that they realized that the house was haunted. They said that things would disappear, turn up in other parts of the residences. Radios turn on and off by themselves. You know, they hear all these different creaks and groans from parts of the house, including the stairs by the front door. They hear footsteps skipping across the floor near the entryway. And at sunset, loud knocks are heard at the front door. And of course, nobody's there. So, as they're in this restore process, they clean a wooden mantelpiece that was in the dining room, and a panel gives way, a secret panel, and it reveals a hidden compartment. Now, one of them reaches inside and takes out an old black and white photograph, and it's a photograph of a young girl, about maybe 8 years old, and she's just wearing a little white dress, you know, like the kind that people would see on children around the turn of the century, early 1900s. And Susan, which is the one that finds it, she's thinking, oh, this is really interesting. And she puts it on a shelf above the fireplace and she keeps on working. Wakes up the next morning, she comes down to the dining room, picture's not there. Nobody can figure out what happened to the picture. Now, that same night, around the time sun's coming down, they hear three loud knocks at the front door. They open the door, and there's nobody there. Then they hear footsteps very lightly go across the floor, and then all of a sudden they see like a glimpse out of the tail of their eye of a small girl dressed in that same type of white dress standing at the landing at the very bottom of the stairs. One moment she's there, next she's gone. Now, over the next weeks, more than one person starts describing the same exact thing of this little girl in the white dress. Question is, was this the same little girl in the photograph that was discovered in that hidden compartment? Now, one day, they get a knock at the door. They open it, and yeah, there was a living person there. It's an older woman, and she tells them that she and her parents had lived in this house for many years, a long time before. And she just saying, can I please come inside? I'd like to take a look. And so they let her in, and she, you know, she's, of course, she starts telling him about her memories of when she lived there. And one of the stories that she starts to tell them immediately gets their attention. And she's saying that during the Great Depression, you know, of course, you know, times were very difficult, and that her family had had to take in boarders. Now, one of them was a mother of a little girl, an 8-year-old girl. She was a single mother. But apparently this girl may be whether what we call behavioral problems. I guess whether she was hyperactive, who knows. At the end of the day, because her mom would lock her in the room as the only way to control her. Probably when she maybe even had to go out to make a living. Anyway, the story goes that one night, as the sun's coming down, somebody knocks at the front door. The family, which was this lady's family, they're in the back of the house, and they don't hear the knocking. So this lady who lives at the top floor, she's rented the room, she comes down the stairs, and she answers the door. Now, she forgets to close her own door behind her, and her eight-year-old daughter runs from the room down the stairs and goes out the front door. She goes out to the street. She's killed by a car. Now, right after this, you know, they have a funeral for the child. This was when they started to hear the creaks and the groans and that sound of a child running near the front door. And then soon afterwards was when they started seeing this ghost right on the bottom of the stairs. And the owners now think that they have the answer as to who is the little girl that they saw. That apparently this child has been haunting this place since Depression. Would it have been around 1929 to 1930s. And she's still reliving those moments when she dashed out the front door and got killed. Next story is, she is waiting forever. Now, this story is about star-crossed lovers, and this ghost is also known as the Lady of the Stairs. And she came from a very prominent family, which, by the way, I did look into the records, and the Gathright family was a very prominent family there in Louisville. So the story is the following. At the corner of 3rd and Ormsby is the First Church of Christ Scientists, and was built in 1916. And this is the site of what's considered one of the most famous hauntings of this area. And what's seen is the ghost of a young girl dressed in white very distressed, pacing back and forth. Now, the backstory to this haunting is that this beautiful lady called Miss G, apparently this was how she was referred to. She graduates from high school in 1918, and her parents are thinking, this is a good time for you to get married. And they start looking at the other families, especially what they call the distilling families. These were the wealthy families that were tied into the bourbon trade. And they choose who they think is a wealthy man for their daughter. He's older. And when she finds out who her parents have picked, she is not happy. She flat out refuses. The parents think it's because he's older, but in truth, that's not it. The truth is that she's already in love with somebody else. Several months before, she had met this young soldier at a party. They had fallen in love. Now remember, this is 1918. World War I is raging in Europe. And he goes off and he's fighting in Belgium. So one of the times that he's on leave, he comes over back to the United States, Kentucky, and he starts to court her. And he's promising her, I'm going to come back and marry you once the war has ended. And he gets discharged from the armed forces. Eventually, her parents find out about this. And of course, they're not very happy. They're thinking that their beautiful daughter is going to marry a man of means. Remember, they're looking at, you know, what could he possibly offer her as far as her future. So, you know, we've all heard some version of this story. She's not in agreement with what her parents want for her. She's 18. So what they do is originally they were from an area called Bardstown. So they're thinking, okay, we're going to keep her away from this young man. And they send her over to Louisville to live with an aunt and uncle who could keep an eye on her. Right now, what they don't know is that this young soldier, he doesn't care that her parents are opposed to the match. He gets discharged. He comes back to the United States, reenlists in the army, because somehow or other he knew that they're going to station him in Louisville at Camp Zachary Taylor, which was about 2 miles from where this church is located. Now, as it turns out, this really facilitates for this young lady to see her lover. Because right across the street from the church is a very popular ice cream shop known as Emord's. So what she would tell her aunt is in the evenings that she was going to meet her friends and at the ice cream shop. Of course, her family is thinking this, what could be more innocent than their niece going to have ice cream with her friends. Now remember, this is the time where everybody knows everybody else. Now what she's doing is once she gets there, within a few minutes, she's telling her friends that she's got to leave, and she goes over to the steps of the church, and this is where her boyfriend is waiting for her. Now several weeks go by, and this is how they're meeting on the sly. And of course, they realize the only way we're ever going to be together is we're going to have to run away and elope. So they plan on meeting, you know, on a certain night. And they're thinking, what we'll do is we'll go from here, take a train over to Chicago where he had family at. They'd get married, stay with his family in Chicago, and then just come back and break the news to her family. And they're thinking, at this point, her parents at this time could not oppose because it would be a done deal. She was married. So the next night, or the night that they had planned to execute this plan, she goes to the ice cream parlor. She shows up and she's got a small suitcase with her. Okay. She does her usual routine. She talks to them and tells him, I gotta leave. She hadn't told anybody about her plans, but her friends have figured out what she's up to. But they're kind of happy for her. Remember, these are probably young girls just like her. And you're just hoping she's going to be happy and she's going to run away with her fiancé. So she's there. She goes to the steps and she's waiting and she's waiting and she's pacing back and forth. Evening goes, wears on, nighttime. She's waiting there for hours and this young man does not show up. Okay. Gets later and later, the shops close up. People start leaving the area. They're walking home and they see her pacing back and forth on the stairs of the church. As a matter of fact, some of them even ask her, is everything okay? And that it's too late, that it's cold, that she shouldn't be out alone, and she needs to go home. And all she does is she shakes her head, she tells him not to worry, and that she's going to be okay. So, of course, she's probably thinking about a million reasons why her young man has not shown up. So, following day, she's not there, of course, and her friends, which kind of suspected her plans, are thinking she's run away to Chicago to be married with a soldier. Now, next day, when the sun goes down, there she is again, pacing back and forth at the columns of this church. However, by this time, she's looking pale. She doesn't look good. She even looks sick. And people are calling out to her, but she's like ignoring them, almost like if she can't see them. And all she does is pace back and forth. Third night, same thing happens. Sun goes down. She appears. She's at the steps again, pacing back and forth. And by this time, the people that are, you know, walking by her are hearing her crying as she goes back and forth. And the residents of this area, old Louisville, they're starting to wonder what is going on. Finally, by the fourth, they find out what's going on. This young soldier never shows up because he's gotten sick. This was during the time when there was an outbreak of the Spanish flu or influenza that it went around the world, the United States. And of course, Louisville, as a matter of fact, it was suspected that many of the soldiers that were coming back from Europe during World War I were the ones that brought this disease into the United States. And he was just one of the soldiers at Camp Zachary Taylor that was struck down by the Spanish influenza. And of course, what they would do immediately with anybody that was found to have this disease was that he was quarantined. So, of course, he is not allowed to go and see his girlfriend. They don't let him. Plus, he's sick. He gets delirious. He's trying to explain to the doctors that his girlfriend's waiting for him, but of course nobody's understanding what he's talking about, and nobody even goes and tells her this is where he's at. He's sick. He can't come. So of course she just waits and waits every night in the cold air, pacing back and forth. And in the end, she goes home and she's thinking that he's just abandoned her. And in the end, she contracts the flu as well. And within 2 days of each other, they're both dead and they're buried. Neither one ever knew what happened to the other. And they say that this is her spirit, Ms. G's spirit, that is seen at the steps, always in that torment of wanting to know what happened to her lover, to the young soldier, to come and take her away. A couple of other houses there are the that are supposedly haunted. Is one's called the Campion House, which is on South 3rd Street. Supposedly, there's a spirit of a stable boy who supposedly roams the alley. And by the way, I did one of the drives that you see me on is down one of these alleys. There's these alleys that run all the way through the back. As a matter of fact, you could drive a car through them, through the back of these mansions. Well, there supposedly is a stable boy who's supposed to roam the alley. Also, the ghost of a suicide victim. Okay. And also, the main house there is supposed to have two young sisters who died from some type of disease or epidemic of some type. There's another ghost over at St. James Court called Avery, And he supposedly haunts a place called the Pink Palace. And Avery is believed to be a former owner. And he supposedly is a tall, older man. And he's known, at one time, one of his sightings was that he was seen by a woman who was taking a bath and causing her to basically jump out of the bathtub. I do that same. And this was right before a stone came sailing through the window and would have hit this lady if she would have stayed where she was at. And this was attributed, I guess, later on, that this was Avery. So anyway, I hope that you love these stories about Louisville.